Subcommittee of Ways and Means. This is Tuesday, June 3rd, 2003, and we will go into work session on House Bill 5021, which is the operations budget for the Department of Higher Education. Mr. Bender, can you open the pathway for us today?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Just to briefly identify the materials that have been distributed to you this morning, there are two sets of materials that are responses by OUS to questions that you had earlier. One is a memo, a two-page memo, on with the responses to additional fee remission questions that you had. So that is distributed for you to review. The other item, which is much more lengthy, is a report that was requested on the situation where OSU had reported a $19 million deficit for the 01-02 fiscal year. There was a request for more information on how that was eventually resolved or further analyzed, and that is a packet of materials that was also distributed to you. So please note that you have those items before you. The third item that you have before you today is something that I prepared, and it's a set of stapled materials that starts with a big table on the top. I'd like to just briefly review what we hope to accomplish today and what we hope to accomplish tomorrow when we wrap up the work sessions for Department of Higher Education operating budget at this point. And that is, today we will be reviewing the resource allocation model and the proposed distribution of funds to campuses under that model. We'll be looking at tuition issues, tuition rate increases, and revenues that are anticipated to be generated from tuition. We'll be looking at the budget reductions and the co-chair's budget, though, of course, you will not be asked to make any decisions on approving or not approving any of those at this point. This is just for information purposes at this time. Tomorrow, what we will do is we will look at some budget notes relating to the resource allocation model and tuition, and also review fund balances that are available at the Oregon University system. So if there are no questions, I'd like to proceed with this table that I've distributed to you. And you don't need to work with this many numbers to be on Ways and Means. And I hope that none of you are people who dislike tables with big numbers. But if you are, don't worry. This is actually a very simple table when you start delving into it. It is. And this is, I think, very helpful to spend a little time looking at this. Because what this is this is the resource allocation model pretty much on one page. It explains how campuses receive the general fund that you appropriate to them in this bill. If you look at the bill, you'll see that there's a single line item in the bill for the education and general fund support. And if you looked at the bill as it was printed, you would see that that number would be in the governor's balanced budget, which is what the printed bill is, $649,720,822, which if you go almost to the bottom of this table, that row that has double lines all the way to the right, that's the number there. Higher ed uses the RAM model to distribute those funds, and this is the way that it's done. And this is the way that it would be done if you just approved the governor's balanced budget proposal without changes. This is how they would distribute those funds. And you can see that funding is basically comes to each campus through two primary forms: self-funding, which is based on the campus's enrollments, and targeted funding, which are specific programs that campuses receive funding for that does not vary generally based on their enrollments. There is even small exceptions to that, but generally the numbers that you see in a targeted number are independent of enrollment. Let's just pick the campus that's easiest to see because it's at the left-hand side, Eastern Oregon University. You'll see that given the cell values, at the governor's balanced budget, Eastern would receive $19.6 million based on the number of students that they are projected to enroll in 03-05 biennium. Then there are a number of targeted programs. Some of them Eastern receives money from, and others it does not. This is fairly typical. Most of the campuses receive funding from some but not all of the targeted programs, and they'll differ from campus to campus. But there's a targeted program for the Western Undergraduate Exchange program, which provides additional funds to campuses who are enrolling students under the Western Undergraduate Exchange program. You can see Eastern doesn't get any funding under that program. But you can see the campuses that do, and it totals, when you look across, it totals just over $1 million, $1,091,999. If you're wondering, or let's talk first about all of these targeted programs as a group. If you're wondering where these totals come from, why is the Western Oregon University number $1,091,999 and not higher or lower than that, what these figures represent are they are the amounts that were applied to these programs this biennium after all of the special session reductions. So this is what was left to campuses after the targeted programs were reduced in special session. What the system will do is they will carry that number forward into the next biennium. Okay, under the governor's balanced budget. Yeah, I don't see anyone shaking their head no, so I assume that's correct.
Representative Smith?
Where does this money come from?
All of this is the part of the state's general fund, so it's all money that you are appropriating to them.
To go to exchange students? What does exchange mean?
These are students that are admitted under agreements with neighboring Western states. And they are only charged, they are not charged, under these agreements, they are not charged the full non-resident tuition rate.
Okay.
They are charged the lower tuition rate. I believe it's 1.5 times the resident tuition rate. And because campuses are therefore not getting the full amount of funds that they would normally get for non-resident tuition, this helps supplement that somewhat and gives them a little extra.
So, Mr. Bender, then, is this in addition to the tuition remission piece that goes to out-of-state or out-of-country students?
These are not tuition remissions. These are funds that do not go to the student or reduce the student's bill. Rather, they go to the campuses to help fund the costs of educating those students. The actual agreement which allows the student to, even though they are non-resident, to receive a reduced tuition rate is part of a reciprocal agreement. Other states are doing the same for Oregon students who are attending their institutions. So if an Oregon student attends an institution, they won't have to pay the full non-resident rate. They just get a break as well. So this was an agreement that has existed for some time that Oregon is a party to, that permits, basically allows some students to get tuition breaks. And these are focused, by the way, for programs where there's capacity to serve more students without, you know, really increasing the costs of the program. So there will be agreements that will say, you know, if we have a situation where there's a certain program that could serve more students without requiring additional substantial investments, this WUI program tells the campuses that they can go out and tell an out-of-state student, well, you can come here, and because of this agreement, you only have to pay 1.5 times the regular resident tuition, which is much less than a normal non-resident tuition. And Oregon students are receiving similar offers from other states.
So is it reasonable then to presume that students that are coming here from other states that this helps offset the cost of?
Yes.
Or offset the half of the, it would be, if they're paying tuition and a half, this mitigates for the other half of the tuition that's missing?
Yes.
And then we would also presume that some of those students would be eligible for tuition remission grants on the campus that they would be enrolling in?
I believe that some of them would be, yes.
They would not be. Could we get some clarification on that?
I don't believe that they would be eligible.
Please come forward. We need to get this on the record.
Good morning. For the record, Dave McDonald, Oregon University System. Your admissions one more time. In response to your question, Chair Morgan, these students generally would not be receiving any additional admission given the fact that they're on the WUI programs.
And my question wasn't specifically would they be eligible for fee remissions because they were on this program. My question was, because they would be coming to the campuses, would the campuses have the flexibility of applying tuition remissions to whatever students are in this pool if they chose to do that?
Chair Morgan, there is no prohibition against that.
Thank you very much. Let's continue along,
okay.
Please.
I don't want to go on this WUI situation too long, but I just to clarify, for a particular institution, like OIT, you see, is the first institution that actually gets money under that program. If OIT enrolls an Oregon student, they get cell value funding for that student because that's considered a fundable student. An Oregon student is a fundable student, and they're getting money in that $18,930,000 for that student. If OIT enrolls a non-resident student that is not in WUI, they don't receive any undergraduate funding for that student because those students are non-fundable. You only fund the Oregon undergraduates. So they don't get any money from the state general fund for that student. Instead, though, as a non-resident, they would get about $12,000 in tuition as opposed to approximately $3,200 for a resident. So they're not getting the state support, but they're getting substantial non-resident support. That's if they're not in WUI.
I'm getting lost.
Oh,
can you
sorry.
Take me through that again?
if an Oregon student goes to OIT, they will pay tuition of about $3,200,
mm-hmm.
and OIT will receive cell value funding because they're a fundable student. That amount varies given what program they're in, but OIT gets the combination of that those two to help support the cost of that student. Second case, a non-resident student. If you're a non-resident student, OIT or whatever campus gets no general fund support specifically for enrolling that student. Mm. They have to be funded. The only money they get specifically for enrolling the student is the tuition. At a non-resident tuition, though, they're paying about $12,000, a little over $12,000 instead of $3,000. So they're getting funding that way. The third case is the WUI student. As a WUI student is always a non-resident, so you don't get any of that cell value funding. The only funding they get from the state general fund is that amount, which adds up in total to $87,000 for all of their WUI students. And that's due to offset the fact that these particular students, they're not paying $12,000 in non-resident tuition. They're only paying 1.5 times the resident rate, which would be about $4,800.
Yeah, I understand. Why does Eastern Oregon University and the Cascade campus not take part in WUI?
Eastern has a unique situation that has been in existence for a long time in that they charge non-resident students the same as resident students. So there's no need for a WUI program. You know, there's no benefit for being in WUI to that. Cascades Cascades is just receiving, they just receive a separate allocation under the RAND. So they receive the amount that is, they would be receiving about $6.8 million, $6.9 million under this level, which is the amount that remained after special session cuts. There was, I believe that the theory is that because that's a new program, in order to achieve stability there, they would just be, allocated a set amount that was then adjusted in special session, and it's not going to vary by enrollment.
Okay. Any further questions on the Western Undergraduate Exchange Program? Representative March, did you have a question? Let's proceed.
The total that the campus receives then is the sum that they receive from all of these targeted programs plus the amount that they receive for their enrollment. So if we look at Eastern, we see that in the self-funding for their enrollment, and again, these are fundable Oregon resident students primarily, except for at the PhD level, all students are counted, but they would receive $19.6 million. Then if you add all of these targeted programs, which they receive money for, you can see almost at the, about three-fourths of the way down, they receive another $9,091,000 from the targeted programs, which is about 31% of their total. And they will receive in total, under the governor's budget, projected $28.7 million.
Can I ask some questions about what some of these programs are? The second one down under the Western Undergrad Exchange is fee remission equity that has its roots in general fund. Can you talk to us about what this is like $830,000?
Yes. I will only be able to talk about this, I admit, in general terms, and I will not be able to give you the specific details, which I didn't bring with me, I'm afraid. But the Fee Remission Equity Program is a program that is designed to help certain institutions support the level of fee remissions that they have in the past been awarding. And it was adopted when the system adopted the RAM model and moved off of the old program to the fee remission to the RAM program about four years ago. I apologize for not having more specificity on that, but if you do, there may be people in the room who could talk about that in more detail.
Who are you pointing to, Grattan? The Chancellor? Mr. Jarvis, you're on the spot here.
Okay.
The question that I have is, what's the purpose of the fee remission equity program? And if you could just tell us a little bit about why it's here. I'm real curious why U of O gets a tiny bit of money out of this.
Madam Chair, Richard Jarvis, Chancellor of the Oregon University System, for the record. As I understand it, Madam Chair, members of the committee, this was a program that was is being phased down as the campuses grow and are able to generate fee remission funding out of their own base. These were funds that were to help the smaller campuses with their ability to provide additional support for students. In our earlier work session with you, we had some discussion on this program, and there was concern about cutting it, and I believe it's fair to say, strong suggestion. I went back to the board and took this off of our reduction list, and the board has agreed to that. So this was something we were going to reduce and phase out, and we have kept this in our budget.
From a personal note, it's very interesting to see how my knowledge of fee remissions has grown since that point.
All of us, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Messerly.
I don't think I heard the answer as to why the U of O has received some of this. So.
From the history, I'm going to have to defer to someone who can give a little more history than I can.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Lauren Stubbert, Assistant Vice Chancellor for OUS. The Fee Remission Equity Program is part of the transition funding scheme that we set up as we developed the resource allocation model. under the previous funding allocation system, the Board of Higher Education controlled tuition revenues as well as state appropriation and allocated funds. And under that, we directed the institutions specifically as to how much fee remission they would allocate out of their resources each year. As we developed the resource allocation model and we were attempting to deal with the new ownership of tuition income by individual campuses and the allocation of general fund through a different model, we realized that some of those previous policies where the fee remissions were somewhat centrally directed, we were creating some inequities between the campuses because of the dramatic change in how resources were distributed to the campuses by the types of revenue that they were able to generate through tuition and how the model distributed the general fund. We created this fee remission equity line as a transition element that we have been phasing down each year since 1999-2000. And it was simply to offset the inequity of how the centrally directed fee remissions were assigned to the campuses and help them cope with transitioning into the new resource allocation model. And we've been decreasing this amount each year to have the campuses then absorb the effect of this as they got accustomed to the new arrangement of how monies were distributed around the system. So it was simply a transition item to help the campuses deal with the dramatic change between the previous allocation system and the resource allocation model that we now use.
Okay, thank you. And now I remember us requesting specifically that you not retain this on your cuts list, and you granting us that request. Are there other members that have... Senator Gordon.
I do. Two questions. The first one about the patient prescription drug program, Senate Bill 9. What is that?
That had been a program that was designed to fund a program at the Oregon State College of Pharmacy to assist individuals in receiving prescriptions at reduced rates that were being offered by pharmaceutical companies, which all have particular programs. The reason that is a zero is during the special session cuts, that funding was eliminated. So that situation and the situation right above it for internships, there had been specific funding to help campuses with their internship programs. In both cases, during the special sessions, those funds were entirely eliminated. And they show here, but if you look there, they remain at zero.
Mm-hmm. And then, Madam Chair,
please,
under collaborative programs, community college partnerships, is shown as zeros across the campuses, but then there's an amount in the OUS
yes.
portion. What does this mean?
The OUS column refers to funds that under the resource allocation model are not distributed immediately to campuses. One of the biggest item in that entire row is the chancellor's office in the middle. That's the funding for the chancellor's office. For many of these other items, though, even though the funding is not initially transferred to campuses, it eventually essentially becomes available to campuses through the forms they apply to the chancellor's office for these particular funds. So these funds would be then distributed by the chancellor's office to support various community college partnerships. Other items that are similar to that is when you look in engineering, you'll see there are significant numbers, dollar amounts, that are in the central budget. But essentially, the vast majority of those are eventually transferred two campuses where the engineering programs are housed.
So, Mr. Bender, what would be the nature of the functions that would be funded by this money?
Which particular money?
The $277,000 in community college partnerships.
These would be, the nature of these would be to help support programs at campuses where they are trying to articulate, I believe is the term, their program offerings with local community college offerings to help students dual enroll and transfer. I don't have a specific list right here of these programs, but that is essentially what these funds are designed to help, the activities that these funds are designed to promote.
Madam Chair?
Senator Masterman.
Wouldn't this, I'm on the wrong message here.
So is this, I mean, this is a very small pot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And it, so what I would assume here is that this is somehow facilitates the transferring and the enrollment of students between community colleges and four-year universities?
Yes.
In certain programs, right?
Please feel free to jump into this discussion anywhere.
Good morning, Madam Chair. From the
Good morning.
Director of Public Relations of the Oregon University System. This is the remainder of a program begun some years ago at a price tag of almost $6 million in the 2001-03 budget. Governor Kitzhaber recommended that be reduced to about $2.6 million, as memory serves, and most of that has been withdrawn during the special sessions as cuts. This is the remainder or the shadow of what had been a very robust program of collaboration between universities and community colleges, primarily in the rural areas in a consortium which was funded between Eastern Oregon University, Blue Mountain Community College, and Treasure Valley. Southern Oregon between Rogue and SOU, between Klamath and OIT and elsewhere, where very robust programs of collaboration and consortia were funded. It has been lost as a result of reductions recommended by the previous governor and through cuts in the five special sessions. As memory serves, Mr. Bender probably has the actual dollars and the dates that they came out, probably not in his head, but certainly in the record. So this is the remainder that is the shadow of what had been a much more robust program.
Representative Smith.
I have a question on the research.
Okay. Well, let me. Are there any more questions on the community college partnerships?
And the explanation is more than adequate. Thank you.
Senator Gordley, before we move to Representative Smith, did you complete your line of questioning?
I did, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Senator, or Representative Smith.
Thank you. On these research, is that somehow our match of what they get in grants for research, or what is that business?
The research funding is designed to help support the research activities. It comes in two components. One component was originally set at 4% of what the research amount was at the campus at the time that the resource allocation model was adopted. So it would no longer be that high because there have been reductions that were taken in special session to that funding. It's still, the title remains the same, but the funding amount has been reduced. The other element of the support is just based on the faculty salary levels and not directly on the amount of sponsored research that's available or that's being awarded. The purpose, again, of these funds is to help support costs of research that are not fully covered by the research grants themselves, and these become part of the bottom line or total funding that the campuses receive to distribute amongst their programs.
I could maybe give you an example. Often the faculty one is used as pilot research, where they might do a small pilot project as a design for a larger funded project. And by doing the pilot, then they can prove to, the say, the feds or whoever they're going after the money for that the project's doable, and then they're eligible to get a lot more money.
Mr. Bender, can you walk us through the campus public service programs?
The campus public service programs are a number of programs that are not directly related to educating students that are in degree or non-degree programs. They are designed to help provide public service to the community, traditionally one of the functions of higher ed. There are a number of public service programs. There's a whole list of them, and I think I have that with me if there's more questions. But in general, some of the larger public service programs that you might have heard of, you see, for example, under OSU, they have a fairly large number there. They would have a number of these. One of them would be the veterinary college. This is to support, that clinic will provide services at below cost, and that would be a public service, and this helps, among other things, to support that program. PSU has a number of these as well. One of the larger ones is the Center for Population and Research and Statistics. I probably got the title a bit wrong. Census. And this function provides information on population that is used by state government and others to determine program needs. Southern Oregon University, one that pops up in my mind, is they do support Jefferson Public Radio to some extent, and these funds help to finance that. The University of Oregon has the LERC, or the Labor Education Research Center, which provides education services in terms of labor negotiations and labor markets. So those are some of the programs that are financed here. And the other, there are more than the, just the ones that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay.
We're just moving down the list here, seeing what it is we want.
Yeah, I would, unless there are any specific questions, I'll just go on. And just
talk to me about why OIT gets $1.7 million for statewide access and no one else gets anything.
Well, statewide access was a program that was developed to help smaller institutions because of the fact that they have a higher per student cost than larger institutions. They're unable to realize the economies of scale that larger institutions can.
Is that because of the technical programs they offer?
No. This actually is not due directly to that. Oh, it is? Oh, I'm sorry.
I figured it was.
The I'm looking down, and then there's a skip a line. The next line down is a regional access program. What's the difference between the two?
Okay.
Lauren Stubbert, Assistant Vice Chancellor for Oregon University System. These three programs under small school funding were an attempt in the development of the resource allocation model to recognize some special needs that these schools have in delivering their, completing their mission, and recognizing the critical mass that they have as small schools. The statewide access monies that go to the Oregon Institute of Technology recognizes the fact that they are the only Institute of Technology in the state of Oregon in the Northwest, and they have a statewide mission in that to deliver their programs in the Portland metropolitan area, particularly out in Clackamas in East Portland area, as well as over in Washington County on the west side. And this was just because of their small size, it's a way of acknowledging that and providing them some additional funding to support that responsibility that they have to deliver those programs.
The if I might interject then, the presumption here is that the cost for OIT to maintain the metro area campuses is higher than the system's ability just based on the revenue that goes into it anyway? Is that what the presumption is?
That was kind of the driving force behind this, yes. It you know, we were designing the resource allocation model, we were identifying these particular needs that campuses had as we were attempting to make sure that we were flowing adequate resources to them through the state appropriation monies. As with the regional access, the Eastern Oregon University, Southern Oregon University, Western Oregon University, as well as OIT, have local responsibilities to support a regional campus for students. And so that resource for the regional access was another means by which we were moving money to them to recognize that area of their responsibility. The small school support adjustment, which is more significant, relates to the fact that as we were developing the resource allocation model, we had an understanding and evidence that these kinds of models that move appropriations out to campuses based on enrollment have limitations as to how effective they are at a certain small size of campus, and that below 7,500 enrollment, it simply does not adequately move sufficient monies to them. And so we developed the small school adjustment to calculate, and it's approximately $650 per student in the gap between what these campuses' enrollment is and 7,500 students. And so it simply is another means by which we're able to acknowledge some of the weaker aspects of the resource allocation model in driving money strictly through the cell values that otherwise provide the enrollment-based funding.
Well, I think that we have had discussions in the committee related to the RAM model and how it does appear to work better for campuses that have a larger size and are nearer population centers than it does for smaller campuses that are in isolated places. Any more questions from the committee on the small school funding piece of this? Okay. Any questions on the engineering component?
Yeah, what is EEIF?
EEIF stands for Engineering Education Investment Fund, and it refers to the additional funds that were applied in the past biennium to expand engineering education programs. The monies, the programs that were funded by the EEIF were worked together by the Engineering Technology Industry Council, a group that involves private industry along with higher ed, to expand enrollments in various high-tech engineering
programs. Is it all general fund?
Yes.
Okay. And
this component is general.
Okay. Is there anything in here that's not general fund?
No. On this page, everything is general fund.
Okay.
Any further questions?
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. If we could go back to targeted programs and the building maintenance, statewide public service, what is that allotment for OSU, and why do no dollars show up in other categories?
That allotment was a item that only goes to OSU because OSU is the campus that houses the statewide public service programs of the Agricultural Experiment Station, Extension Service, and Forest Research Laboratory. Those received separate line item appropriations that don't show up in this table because we're just looking at education in general. But these particular facilities, or these particular programs, I'm sorry, operate, you know, take up or use facilities on the OSU campus, both on the campus itself and off campus. They're using these facilities, which the upkeep and maintenance of is being funded out of the education in general funding to OSU. It's a function of how they were budgeting. So because the allocations that you provide directly to the public services does not cover the cost of the maintenance of their facilities, and that is covered out of the education and general budget of Oregon State. This item is designed to show where those costs are being paid out of.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Messerly.
I think you spoke a little bit to it, Mr. Bender, but could you go in more depth of why the statewide are not included in this spreadsheet?
They are not included because the statewide public services, very often in the documents that OUS puts together, they actually do include them in this table. I did not include them because they receive their funding is a separate line item, and the amount that they distributed to those is determined by you in the bill, and it's not a situation where there's a number that you provide in the bill which is then divided up amongst various elements.
Is statewide's general fund?
They do receive general fund.
All general fund?
They also have other funds in their budgets as well. And we'll be talking about the statewides tomorrow.
Thank you.
Remember that part of the funding comes from the counties.
Right.
The building and some of the supports there. Okay. Were there other things you wanted to talk to us about how the spreadsheet was constructed?
Just to show, if you look at the very bottom of the spreadsheet, that, again, the row that has the double underlined is the funding that the campuses would receive under the governor's balanced budget. The row below that is the amount that they were to receive at the 2001 regular session before the funding cuts of special session. So you can see that in all cases, funding that's proposed at the governor's level is less than what had been approved last session before you had to make cuts because of the state budget shortfall. And you can see the percentage changes. They do vary by campus, but all in every instance, there is a reduction in general fund compared to what campuses thought they would be getting after the 2001 session ended last time.
Questions, comments? Please proceed, Mr. Bender.
The next page, which is labeled page 1B, looks at the campus budgets in a somewhat broader scope, because in addition to the general fund, we include the other funds limited that are used to help pay the bills. The other funds limited are primarily tuition and fee revenues, though there are some other sources there as well. But if you look, for example, at Eastern, you'll see in 2001-03, the biennium that we're in, it's estimated that they're going to receive about $27.7 million from general fund. This is after, unlike on the earlier page, this is after all the special session cuts. So this is what they are estimated to actually receive. These numbers, by the way, I must say that in both of these tables, I just got them done, completed this morning, and higher ed has not had time to review them, so they cannot confirm for you whether these numbers are correct or not. I do believe that they are, and but I was not able to give them time to look them over. The other funds limited is the estimated amount of other funds, you know, tuition fees and other funds. So altogether, Eastern Oregon had a budget for its education in general limited programs of about $45.8 million. And you can read across for each of these.
Is it also fair to say that in 0103 and 0305 that Eastern Oregon University will receive about $1 million more in this biennium than last biennium in the general fund piece of it, and that the tuition has gone from $18 million to almost $22 million?
Yes.
And so then it's a function of the resource allocation model, that some of the campuses would receive more general fund than 0103 and some less?
Let's see. I'm not sure that any of them are receiving less.
More. Okay.
Again, the reason for the difference is this is how much the earlier page compared what they had originally budgeted for. This compares what was left after they had to take all the cuts. So you're starting with something lower, and now it looks like there's an increase there. And, you know, there is. It's not, it looks like that's what's actually happening. They will be getting more money under the governor's balanced budget in 03-05 than they did end up receiving in general fund this biennium.
But also there's large increases in the tuition and fee piece.
And that's what this is showing here. Again, if you look at row 58, that's what we believe the campuses have available in their budgets this biennium, which is almost over. And if you look at rows 60 through 66, this is what we believe campuses would have if you approved the governor's balanced budget level of general fund. That's that row 61 is the same that was on the previous page. It's identical. And you approved the tuition limitation, expenditure limitation for tuition, at the tuition rates that the governor's budget supports. The governor's budget supports a tuition increase of 2% per year each of the next 2 years for resident students, and of 3.5% per year for each of the next 2 years for non-resident students, but it supports them from at an increase from what the rates were before tuition surcharges were imposed. So actually, these tuition rates are less than what campuses are currently charging. But the governor's budget shows that if you did approve that and you just didn't make any adjustments, line 66 or row 66 shows the impact on the total budget to each campus if you approved those governor's budget and compared that to what they ended up having in 0103. And you can see that the situation varies. For a campus like Western, there's only a 2.9% increase. And since these are estimates, I mean, probably my guess would be that the increase would actually be a little less in all cases than is being shown here. So they have very little change in funding. Other campuses, however, such as University of Oregon, Portland State, Eastern Oregon University, show significantly larger increases in their budgeted amounts under the governor's balanced budget when you look at these other funds as well as the general fund. What the final set of figures shows in rows 69 through 75 is, it shows this row 70, which is the general fund, is the same as before. It's the same that you saw on the previous page. It's the same that you see in row 61 on this page. That's what the governor's balanced budget has for, you know, the $649 million. That's what's in there. But if the tuition levels as proposed by the institutions, that is to say actually implemented, the tuition surcharges that have actually been approved, plus the actual increases that the board is proposing are approved, we would expect more other funds revenue than under the governor's balanced budget. So row 71 is higher than row 62, right, because these are higher tuition rates. Mm-hmm. And when you add these numbers together on row 73, mm-hmm, this is what the institutions would have if you approve the governor's balanced budget amount for general fund and you essentially acknowledge that and allowed expenditures of tuition rate increases that are anticipated, that have been imposed and are anticipated to be imposed. You see the situation is better for the institutions in this case.
And then the net result is that the budgets to all the campuses increases by 17.5%.
To the campuses by 18.3%. The centralized, there's a reduction in the centralized.
I see. Okay, so total overall, campuses 18.3. If you factor in the reduction to OUS, it's 17.5. Yeah. Okay, so under either of these funding scenarios, the governor's balanced budget tuition rates or the proposed tuition rates, there are rather sizable increases to the budgets.
Right. And at the same time, do realize there are increases in costs to the institutions as well. Their costs are not remaining constant. Costs are going up for a number of factors. And also, some of the institutions are having increases in enrollment, which would also tend to increase their costs. So it's not as if, you know, there's just all this extra money coming in without additional costs. But this is showing what the bottom line would be for available to budget.
Questions, comments?
Hi.
Representative Smith?
Hi.
The huge tuition increase. Does the system, would you like to come forward and react to this? And I realize that you haven't had time to see it, so I would be very willing to have you come back in tomorrow's session and comment on it, if that would be better.
Madam Chair, Tom Andrews of the Oregon University System, it probably will be better to come back tomorrow in a fairly comprehensive way. I think to understand just very briefly the line 71 where you'll see the proposed tuition increases. That includes, as Mr. Bender said, the tuition surcharges plus the increases in 03-05. That is intended to reflect and work toward a number of goals. Number one, the surcharges were in place because of the reductions in 2001 and 03. Those extend forward. We are anticipating, we would love to get the governor's balanced budget. We would love that. But we've had to plan for the potential that we would not receive that. And right now, under the governor's revised budget and under the co-chair's budget, we're looking at $35 to $75 million reductions beyond this. We're also looking at potential for handling enrollments on the margin. We're looking at anywhere with the kinds of reductions that we've talked about, of potentially 3 to 6 in that range of additional enrollments. That's additional costs that we'll have. It's not reflected in here. And also PEB costs. There are increases right now that have been proposed by PEB that would have an impact on us at a particular plan out of approximately $18 million. Now, if that's funded by the state, in some portion of it, that's going to be great. If it isn't, this is another resource that we have to look at. So we're looking at all of those pieces that, as we talked about the increased tuition, that we're really looking in some ways as at a backfill to what's happening with the general fund. But we can come back with a little more detail tomorrow.
I recognize we had a pretty thorough discussion during your budget presentation on the impacts of taking students on the margin and the fact that there's no general fund match, and so in order to cover those costs, it falls entirely to tuition to do that. Thank you, and I would welcome you to come back tomorrow and give a more detailed analysis of this.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Bender.
There aren't any other questions. I would move on then to the next page, which is labeled page 2.
People are looking very contemplative, but I don't see anyone wanting to ask a question. Please proceed to page 2.
This page includes or has a description of what the tuition rates are at the 7 campuses by category of student: resident undergraduate, non-resident undergraduate, resident graduates, and non-resident graduates. The total bill is higher than this. This is the part that's tuition, and that goes into the limited budget to help support with general fund the education and general programs. If you ignore for a moment my hand-scribbled numbers, you can see that these include the rates that are being charged this term, spring term, 2002-03 final approved rates. That includes the proposals for increases for 03-04, that is to say starting next fall, and the fall after that. Just looking at the resident undergraduates, you can see that the rate increases are varying by institution. So there's considerable variation in the increases that are projected. You can see, I mean, there are a huge number of numbers on here. It takes a while just to sit down and look at all of it, but that's basically the information that you have there, and you can see the types of tuition rates. The numbers that I've handwritten in, so for example, the 25% number that you see after Eastern on the front first row, what that represents is the proposed tuition for 03-04, that's the 3102 number, is a 25% increase over what the tuition started at in 02-03. So it's the initial rate as opposed to the final rate. So this shows you to some extent, if you compare the tuition next fall to what it was this fall, this past fall, there's a 25% increase in Eastern, 20% increase in OIT. The number that you see of 3.2% shows that there will be a 3.2% increase from what the spring rate was, but this is just additional information to show you what's happening with tuition at OUS.
So just to reiterate then, Mr. Bender, if I was to take for Eastern Oregon University the annual tuition rate for 03-04 and then the annual tuition rate for 01-03, the difference would be 25%?
Yes. 25% of the 01, of the original cost, it increased 25% to get you to 3102.
Well, but it's still considerably lower than the other institutions, and in part because we're able to do the small school subsidy.
Well, and I use that only as an example to make sure that I'm understanding what the numbers are, but the increases in tuition over 1 year ago are very interesting comparisons. Please proceed, Mr. Bender.
LFO tomorrow is going to bring suggested language, and we will get this to higher ed. We'll email it to them later today after it's written up so that they can see that before coming in tomorrow. But basically, to convey, we believe that when you approve a budget, you should indicate your expectations of what's happening with tuition revenues. So that the system understands what you're expecting in terms of tuition revenues and tuition rates. Note that the legislature does not set tuition rates. By law, these are set by the State Board of Higher Education, and that will continue to be done, and it has been done in the past. But we believe that in order to budget for these institutions, it's important for the legislature to have an understanding of what the other funds available to the campuses will be, in addition to what the general funds will be. So that will be something that we'll have for you tomorrow.
Mr. Bender, with relation to the percentage increases year over year in the non-resident undergraduate and the non-resident graduate program, it appears that you, in a general sense, you see significantly lower tuition increases in the non-resident programs when you compare them to the resident programs?
I think in general, for some of the institutions that would be true. For others, for the non-resident versus resident. I'm sorry, I'm looking at comparing the wrong thing.
The non-resident were generally more competitive, I think, to begin with.
The non-resident rates are higher, clearly, and the board may have felt that the market would not be able to absorb significant increases in those rates. But this would have been a decision that the board had made.
Would it be possible, Mr. Anders, could you come forward and talk to us a little bit about why the undergraduate rate increases are at a lower level than the resident increases?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, a couple of things have happened over the last few years. You'll find that on the non-resident side, there was no freeze. There had been a freeze of the undergraduate resident for 3 or 4 years up until 01, I believe. So you were then having the undergraduate res held at an artificial level. I won't say low, but an artificial level. What you had was the opportunity for the universities to raise non-resident, graduate and undergraduate. And basically what you're seeing is that they were constantly trying to stay with as much as they could in with the marketplace. One of the pieces of information that we shared with the committee during the regular discussions had to do with our relationship with our peers. Every institution has a set of peers in terms of tuition and fees. And that's a relatively important part of the decision-making for the board in looking at that and what's happening with non-residents in particular. Same time as the freeze was lifted on the undergraduate residents, graduate residents, what we were trying to do, again, partly it's to fill a gap. No, you know, there's no question. We're trying to fill a gap in terms of what was happening on the general fund side, but we were also looking at our peers and saying, okay, what seems to be reasonable in the context of both the shortfall in the general fund side and what was happening competitively with our peers. So that's kind of the difference between the rates in the two. And it'll vary a bit on campuses. Some campuses would have maintained a relatively low to their peers non-resident rate and said, you know, this is a time we've really got to look at our market and we've got to increase it a little bit more. So that's why you see a variation. Eastern, as an example, particularly on the undergraduate side, had been quite low relative to even in state. So where you see a fairly large increase of 25%, that is really putting them right in the same line then with the rate increases for the or with the rates generally for the other universities in Oregon, the regionals.
Thank you. Shall we move ahead?
The last item that I have here is, this item was prepared by the Oregon University System. It's page 3A, to discuss the principles of how the RAM model will be operated during the upcoming biennium. And if you look at these, you will see that there is an intention to fund cell values, or to keep cell values, I should say, at the 72nd percentage level. And there are a number of principles that are being identified here. And I thought it might be easier to understand how these principles are being implemented through a little example, which I've included on page 3B, to show what the system will be doing in terms of implementing the RAM during the 2003-05 biennium. What this page shows is how the RAM cell values are calculated, typically without the modifications that are being proposed in 2003-05. And just to use round numbers, these are not the real numbers by any means, just to give you an idea of how RAM cell value percentages, when you hear we're being funded at this percent or that percent, this is how that number comes about. Suppose, for example, that there was a projected, the enrollment was a fundable student, so these are basically the Oregon students, was projected to be 1,000 FTE. And suppose that the state, you appropriated $1.2 million to this particular system, and they were going to use $200,000 of that for targeted programs and $1 million of that, the remainder, for their cell value funding. Now, these numbers, of course, these three numbers, the $200,000, the $1 million, the $1.2 million, are numbers that you provide. You're the one, you know, they can't adjust that. What they would do is, they, typically, without modifications, in a pure, if we want to use it, RAM model, they would take the $1 million, divide it by the 1,000 fundable FTE, and provide funding of essentially $1,000 per FTE, because 1,000 times 1,000 is a million. In reality, it's much more complicated. There isn't one single number. There are numerous cells that vary, so this would have to be some kind of average. And there are some restrictions on graduate caps that have been imposed in the past, which I don't even want to really get into right now. But that is what this hypothetical system would do if this was the hypothetical enrollment and appropriation level. Now, independently of all of these calculations, there was a review of the peer institutions and to see what the peer institution funding per FTE averages out to.
And by peer institution, you are referring to?
These are specific sets of institutions. One set of institutions for the three larger campuses, another set of institutions for the three smaller regionals, and a third set of peers specifically for OIT. There was a review that was done before the RAM was adopted of how much funding was being provided on average by these peer institutions. And since that review, that number has not been, they haven't done it again, but they've been adjusting that just for inflation each year. But there would be some number that would have come out of that analysis. And suppose, for the sake of example, it's turning out that the peer institutions are funding at $1,250 per FTE. There isn't enough money here for self-funding to provide all 1,000 students $1,250 per FTE. You would need $1.25 million to do that, but there's only $1 million to do that. So what higher ed does is they reduce the cell values and they fund everyone at the 1,000 per FTE, which is all that they can do, and they express that as 80% of what the peer funding level is. They just take the 1,000 divided by the 1,250, and the simple math is 80%. So you'll hear, the funding available is at 80% in this case. And when higher ed makes their budget requests to the governor, typically they will look at this and they'll say, we're expecting 1,000 students and our peers to have as much funding as our peers would to serve 1,000 students, we'd need $1,250,000. And they would typically have packages or requests to increase their funding, because it's always been less than 100%, up to the 100% level, or in some cases more modestly, not to the full 100% level, but maybe to the 90% level. These requests would go forward, and they've always, the governor's never approved these types of requests, and you don't even see them by the time we get to the governor's balanced budget. And in this particular case, where the state's funding situation is so dire, certainly none of these types of requests to increase the cell funding have made it into the governor's balanced budget. Instead, there are a number of reductions in there instead. But this is how the cell value number would work in a pure RAM model. And then I've just given you some actual figures that I didn't use in the calculations because the math would have been not very nice. But what we're actually projecting, or what the institutions are actually projecting next biennium, is, as you can see, just a shy of 125,000 fundable FTE. And the cell value funding, which was back here on page 1A, if you want to see that number, but the amount in the governor's budget is $517.4 million. And if you just do a simple division, you'll see that the funding per fundable student is about $4,140, though it varies. They would vary it, of course, by program type. There would be many cells. But on average, if you did a weighted average, it would be $4,140. And if you looked at their peer institutions and averaged those out, the peers would be about 6,061. So the funding percentage that they would have applied without any modifications, if they just ran the pure RAM model, in order to get the amount distributed down to the 517.4 that's in the budget, is they would have set the percentages at 68.3%.
Mr. Bender, are the peer institution funding numbers calculated on an annual basis?
I believe that yes. And actually, even though we budget biennially, the institutions themselves do budget annually and receive two separate distributions, annual distributions. So what we say here, I guess what, maybe I'm not exactly answering your question. When we say $4,140, that would be for each of the 2 years.
Right.
That's not double. And it would be the same. It is an apples-to-apples comparison.
What I was curious about is if everyone is computing their funding percentage based on last year's funding revenue number for their peer institutions, then it would seem that in the situation we're in, where we're in a falling revenue situation, that we're always going to be out of sync on the downside, and we're in a rising revenue situation, we're going to be out of sync on the upside.
You're correct, and the peer number there, the 6,061, is not even based on a year or two ago. It's based on when the study was done, when the RAM model was originally established, and that number was lower then, and it's been increased for inflation. So it's in that sense, it's not a current type of percentage.
So when are these numbers truthed up to what's actually going on in the real world?
Well, I don't know how often they're able to do that.
Mr. Anders?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we are in the process right now of finalizing kind of the re-review from looking at the initial cell values, the disciplines, the costs through the peer study that we had done in 98 or 99. And we are right now just finalizing kind of that first analysis to upgrade the comparisons with our peers. And initially what we're finding is we're actually farther behind. We're not really at the 72 as it suggests there. And that would be costs, I think, through 02. So we won't have, like, through 03, but we've got it up through 02 with our peers.
So is it the intention of the cell value system as a whole to only actually truth the numbers up every 10 years?
Madam Chair, no. I think the intention had been that when the model first was implemented, that we were supposed to come back by the end of the second biennium. In each of the years leading up to that, we were going to be doing, as Mr. Bender said, we just applied inflation to our values. Obviously, during that period of time, there's a lot of changes taking place with the peers, as you're suggesting, and we really should be updating that every 2 years. It's fairly labor-intensive, but that's really what we need to do to be as current as possible.
So is it realistic, to given the amount of work you're talking about, to reassess it every 2 years?
Madam Chair, it's very difficult, but I'm not sure, given the questions that you have. The data is available. The problem is that if we have a severe drop-off in general fund availability, if we're coming back to you and talking about large increases in tuition, I think we have to have as current a set of information as possible so that we're comfortable and you're comfortable with how those peer relationships may have shifted. And if we do it every 4 years, there's less reliability to that.
Well, it is interesting, too, that we've come off of a 10-year period of time where the growth in funding that's available to states to spend has grown hugely. And now we're in a time where it's fallen off precipitously in a short amount of time. And it would seem like it would be very interesting, I think, to truth the numbers up, to try to get some kind of look at what's going on. But it sounds like the data you're saying that you're going to update through the end of 2002?
Correct.
So it will begin to show the downswing, but well, it'll be interesting to see that.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think what will really be interesting is as we know what's happening with our institutions, it's really looking at what's happening with other institutions, because we hear about them having the same problems, similar problems, but frequently there's more of a focus on Oregon and the degree to which we've taken reductions. So getting that more accurate assessment is going to help everybody.
Thank you. Mr. Bender.
Now, the proposal for 2003-05, which again reflects what you see on page 3A, I'm sorry, is to make some changes in this. And that is, the first one, under proposed modifications, the funding percentage will be maintained at 72.19%, or perhaps just an even 72%, instead of the 68.3% that would show up in the governor's budget. So the question is, well, first of all, what the heck does that mean, and how can they do it? Well, they can't get additional general fund in order to raise it from the 68.3% to 72%, because the decider of how much general fund they get is you and not themselves. But what they can do is they're doing it through method number two. They're going to achieve this by limiting or reducing the number of FTE that are funded to a number that will be less than the full amount that's projected. So even though there are 124,988 FTE that are projected, what the system is going to do is they're only going to fund the amount that is currently enrolled this year, doubled for 2 years of the biennium. That's to say they're not going to fund any enrollment growth. It's just flat what we have now. If you look at how many students we have this year and double it, fundable students, you'll see in number three of the proposed modification that that would total a bit over 118,000. So what they were going to do is they're saying we're only going to fund the first 118,000 students. And in that case, if we do that, the 517 million that we would get if you approve the governor's budget would be equal to 72%, because you're not spreading it out as much.
Can we stop there for a moment?
Sure.
Because I thought we just heard from Mr. Anders that we may be further behind the 72%. Is that what you said?
Yes, that is, Madam Chair and Representative Borlina.
So if that's the case, then why are we basing the projection on 72%.
Madam Chair, Representative Gortley, Senator Gortley, sorry. We're always going to be in some sort of period where we're in a transition on enrollments. There's no question about that. And where we're at right now is we're saying we've pegged 72% based on the most current information we have. When we can come back and we can reassess that and finalize a number, it may turn out to be something that is lower than that. The board has to make the decision. Are we willing to, and kind of the whole balancing, are we willing to go down below 70, or is the access issue and the enrollments the key component? Mm-hmm. Right now, the board's position is 72%. Even as general fund is reduced, we will stay at 72%. Therein comes, I think, the next point that Mr. Bender wanted to speak to in terms of how we could handle additional enrollment on the margin.
Proceed. Just stay there, Mr. Anders, if you would. Thank you.
So the 72% figure is not arbitrary. Mm-hmm. It represents, at the governor's balanced budget, what the funding would be if there were no enrollment growth in the system. That's the rate that they could fund these students at. To the extent that the actual legislative approved budget, if it were to be less than the governor's balanced budget amount, they would maintain the funding level per student at 72%. They wouldn't lower that number per student, but since there was less money available, they would be able to include fewer students in the model. To the extent that, let's go back to the governor's balanced budget just for a minute. To the extent that a campus does grow, if their enrollments do grow, what happens is the following. No one tells them that they can't take additional students, but you don't get additional general fund because the amount is capped at the current year enrollment level. And when you take in that additional student, you have to just finance their expenses from the tuition revenue they bring in. As a campus, you don't get additional general fund support for them. The projections are, and of course these are all projections, and we don't know if this is going to happen or would happen, but the projection is that campuses would enroll approximately 6,700 students on this basis throughout the system. Some campuses wouldn't enroll any, others would enroll some. It would total up to about 6,700. And the total enrollment then would be that number we've been talking about, the 124,988. And again, principle or modification number five, if you approve something like the co-chair's budget, which has significantly less funding for cell values than the governor's balance budget, what OUS will do is they'll just reduce the number that's funded to the amount that whatever is available allows, whatever that simple math division allows. They'll reduce it to that number to maintain 72.19% for those students who are funded. And the question then, I think, really is, well, what does this all really mean? What's the practical, very practical effect of these making these modifications, as opposed to if they chose not to make any of these modifications and just run the pure RAM that we were talking about above? And there are two practical effects, and those are shown as A and B. The first is that the campus funding levels will become less dependent on their enrollment levels. Okay, they won't fluctuate as much due to variations in enrollment. And the reason, again, is some of these enrollments are not being funded anyway. So if the total enrollment of a campus, if a campus has 300 extra students as opposed to only pulling in 20 extra students, there's no change in their funding. In either case, they get the same amount. It's more stable. In the old case, the funding that they would get would fluctuate more. Now, take the institution that doesn't have any gain in students. Under the old case, when their sister institution had 300 growth, they would get more money from that, but it has to come from somewhere. So it would come from the institutions that maybe have flat enrollment. So under the pure RAM, an institution with flat enrollment could find their or would find their allocation dropping just because another institution was growing. And that's the way it works under the pure RAM. But in this particular case, because the general fund amount is down from what it was projected to be in 0103, and it's up a little bit from what it turned out to be in 0103, but not very much. In terms, you know, we're just talking general fund in here. The system has decided to promote stability and to not have a situation where campuses that don't grow, or campuses that, even if they're growing but more at a slower rate than their sister campuses, they won't be hit as hard. There's less shifting of funding. So slower growing campuses will get more than they would have without these modifications. Faster growing campuses would get less. And again, the theory behind this is that this is a situation where the total general fund available is very tight. And it's an attempt, I think, to try to preserve funding for campuses that won't be able to grow very rapidly in this environment. The other practical outcome of this is that we would expect that enrollments, campuses would enroll fewer students in total than they would without these modifications because they get less financial compensation when they enroll a new student. So now if you enroll an additional student, all you get is their tuition. Whereas before, you would get additional tuition plus additional general fund. So it became much more affordable to afford to enroll additional students before. Under this situation, it's less affordable, and we would expect enrollments not to grow as rapidly. Those are the two practical outcomes, and the effect of both A and B become even stronger the lower the amount of the state appropriation is. And you know, these are policy decisions on a budget, pure budgetary basis. It seemed like very reasonable modifications given the budget environment of the system.
Mr. Bender, I think you've done an outstanding job of explaining the challenges that trying to make the RAM model work in a falling general fund revenue scenario presents to the system. And I think that, once again, it just points out that there are challenges both in rising revenue and falling revenue situations for the funding model in terms of trying to protect the campuses that are smaller and more isolated. And again, a challenge of trying to make this model work. Do people have questions, Representative March?
Yeah, I was just kind of looking at the targeted programs, and in a way, the targeted programs are attempting to do much of the same thing regarding the slower growing campuses. So, I mean, are we overcompensating? I mean, putting a fixed number in the RAM model, which was, we did the targeted programs to take care of the slower growing and smaller campuses, and then are we overcompensating by again capping in there? That's a question.
Mr. Anders, would you like to give us the benefit of your thought on that question, which I think does cut to the heart of the matter?
Madam Chair and Representative March, we don't think so. What we see right now, particularly with the regional campuses, is much less. The purpose of the model has been to compete, to grow, and to be rewarded for the growth. The targeted programs, to some degree, bring the campuses, the regional campuses, on the access issues up to a somewhat of a fairer playing field, we think. However, as we've moved through this biennium, even some of those targeted programs have been reduced. Their enrollment growths have been flat to very slight growth, or they've been on target, but as the larger universities have grown, they've literally taken more and more resources away from the campuses, from the regional campuses. And the model worked. It's working well. I mean, the model is working as it's supposed to. The only thing we've got going right now is we're suggesting, in effect, a two-year moratorium. We would come back to you in 2 years, and we would say, okay, based on the parameters of revenues, what's happening with tuition, general fund, we want to move back to the conditions where an institution that can clearly grow and under the original constraints or the parameters of the model where they could grow and be rewarded for that, we want to move back to that, or we want to modify it somehow. But right now we're just into that period of time where we think we found the baseline for each of the institutions, but particularly the smalls. And all we can see with further reductions and limited growth in enrollments is the same kind of circumstances that happened in this biennium.
Mr. Anders, I would submit, though, that the RAM system was implemented in a revenue growth period of time. That clearly we're not in that kind of a situation anymore. And in a revenue growth situation, the RAM model, as a pure application without any of the adjustments, didn't allow the small campuses to survive. And so now you've got, because you're in a falling revenue situation, you've got even more stress on the system, because if all things were equal, the larger campuses that are near the population centers could continue to add students on the margin at a fairly robust rate and be able to make the funding work. The rural campuses, the more isolated campuses, would be killed by the transfer of funding that would occur under that scenario without the protections. So I would submit to you that you have a model that doesn't work in either rising revenue or falling revenue unless you put some artificial supports into it.
Madam Chair, that's correct. In a sense, the targeted programs, which also benefit the large institutions, I mean, we've got the ETIC engineering components. We have other aspects of the targeted programs which are mission-based and help the larger institutions as well. But there's no doubt, the model as it exists specifically cannot encompass an institution from 2,000 to one that's 24, 25,000 in those cell values. So there's got to be those, as you mentioned, artificial sorts of adjustments that are done for access. We've got them for the, when you looked at the technology piece, there's an undergraduate technology piece. And unless we were to simply create separate models, one for the large, one for the small, or even more refined than that, this would be the only way to be able to attain some level of equity as we're looking at what's happening with the institutions.
I agree, and I think the point that I'm trying to make is that rather than looking at the RAM model as the savior of the university system, that I think we need to be more realistic and realize and discuss the fact that there are huge shortcomings to it, no matter what kind of revenue situation you're in, and deal with it on that basis. And Senator Mezeva, you had a question.
Well, I do. Maybe it's more of a statement, Madam Chair, but I guess there would be a question, too. And as I'm sitting here and recognizing that this is my first year on this committee, but trying to find some comfort level with, or just a good gut feeling of what's going on here, it seems to me that the one thing we're lacking, particularly in a stressed financial situation like we're in right now, at least for my case, is an understanding of two factors. Number one is, what is the capacity of these campuses, and could they add students and gain some efficiencies from this, quite frankly? And I would guess that could vary widely on the different campuses we have across the state. And so, but it seems to me that as you try to pull this RAM model together and combine that with the financial situation we have, that is a factor that I'm not hearing talked about.
Madam Chair and Senator Messerly, we have our capacity, or what we've looked at in terms of capacity, has been over the last 4 or 5 years, we've been looking down the road 10, 12, 15 years. We've been looking at what the demand would be, or what we've projected it to be, and in a sense, we have, I think, a fairly good feeling about what the capacity would be at each campus, again, based on what we see as the demand. The model right now, as it's functioning, as it functioned in the first 2 years of the biennium, or when it was first implemented, worked really very well. I mean, and partly when you're at a level of 88-89% of funding, minor issues are minor. But as that declined down to 84, down to 74, down to 72, the issue of capacity has literally been one, how can we limit capacity? I mean, we've kind of digressed to the point where we created a model that was to stimulate growth. Now we're trying to figure out, how do you pull back with this present model and limit growth, but yet still let institutions grow kind of on this margin? And I think in response to your concern, that the downward slope is much more of a concern as it relates to the model. I think there's ways of, as you're working on a relatively stable or growth component, the model will work. You're still going to have some of these artificial sorts of increments that will be included. But it's the downside that is an issue. And we certainly don't meet the full capacity or the full demand. And I think those are really something we do have to look at closely. The board has made a real commitment over the last number of months of looking at the concerns for issues of quality. That's why they set the 72%. The access issue, we know the capacity, we know the demand, and we know we can't meet that right now under the present constraints. So I think just getting to your point, we do have to look closely at that model and how it functions.
Members, we have successfully talked ourselves to the conclusion of another meeting here. Mr. Bender, we have some things that are on tap for tomorrow. Can you talk to the committee about what we'll be working at tomorrow?
Yes, Madam Chair, members. Tomorrow will be the last day you have scheduled a work session for higher ed until you come back to this budget later in the session to make final budget decisions. What we propose to cover for you or to have you cover in tomorrow's meeting is a discussion of the co-chair's budget as it relates to Department of Higher Education operations, a review or discussion of the fund balances that are available in the Department of Higher Education, and finally, some specific recommendations to you in terms of budget notes relating to conveying expectations for tuition levels, fee remissions, and an acknowledgement of an understanding of how the system is planning to distribute RAM funds. And then finally, a discussion of the budgets of the statewide public services.
Thank you. And if there is no further comment on the part of the committee members, this meeting is adjourned, this work session is closed, and we'll reconvene tomorrow morning at 8:30.